Chapter 23. Crossed the railway by a bridge. As he neared home, the anxiety lately written in his face merged by degrees into a grimly humorous smile, which hung long upon his lips, and he quoted aloud a line from the book of Jeremiah, "A woman shall compass a man." ... 3. November the 19th. Daybreak, before it was light the next morning, two little naked feet pattered along the passage in Knapwater House, from which Owen Gray's bedroom opened, and a tap was given upon his door. "Owen, Owen, are you awake?" ... said Cytherea in a whisper through the keyhole. "You must get up directly, or you'll miss the train." ... When he descended to his sister's little room, he found her there already waiting with a cup of cocoa and a grilled rasher on the table for him. A hasty meal was dispatched in the intervals of putting on his overcoat and finding his hat, and they then went softly through the long deserted passages, the kitchen maid who had prepared their breakfast walking before them with a lamp held high above her head, which cast long wheeling shadows down corridors intersecting the one they followed, their remoter ends being lost in darkness. The door was unbolted, and they stepped out. Owen had preferred walking to the station to accepting the pony carriage which Miss Aldclyffe had placed at his disposal, having a morbid horror of giving trouble to people richer than himself, and especially to their men servants, who looked down upon him as a hybrid monster in social position. Cytherea proposed to walk a little way with him. "I want to talk to you, as long as I can," she said tenderly. Brother and sister then emerged by the heavy door, into the drive. The feeling and aspect of the hour were precisely similar to those under which the steward had left the house the evening previous, excepting that apparently unearthly reversal of natural sequence, which is caused by the world getting lighter instead of darker. The tearful glimmer of the languid dawn was just sufficient to reveal to them the melancholy red leaves, lying thickly in the channels by the roadside, ever and anon loudly tapped on by heavy drops of water, which the boughs above had collected from the foggy air. They passed the old house, engaged in a deep conversation, and had proceeded about 20 yards by a cross route, in the direction of the turnpike road, when the form of a woman emerged from the porch of the building. She was wrapped in a gray waterproof cloak, the hood of which was drawn over her head, and closely round her face so closely, that her eyes were the sole features uncovered. With this one exception of her appearance there, the most perfect stillness and silence pervaded the steward's residence from basement to chimney. Not a shutter was open, not a twine of smoke came forth. Underneath the ivy-covered gateway she stood still, and listened for 2, or possibly 3 minutes, till she became conscious of others in the park. Seeing the pair she stepped back, with the apparent intention of letting them pass out of sight, and evidently wishing to avoid observation. But looking at her watch, and returning it rapidly to her pocket, as if surprised at the lateness of the hour, she hurried out again, and across the park by a still more oblique line than that traced by Owen and his sister. These in the meantime had got into the road, and were walking along it as the woman came up on the other side of the boundary hedge, looking for a gator stile, by which she too, might get off the grass upon the hard ground. Their conversation, of which every word was clear and distinct, in the still air of the dawn, to the distance of a quarter of a mile, reached her ears, and withdrew her attention from all other matters and sights whatsoever. Thus arrested she stood for an instant as precisely in the attitude of Imogen by the cave of Belarius, as if as he had studied the position from the play. When they had advanced a few steps, she followed them in some doubt, still screened by the hedge. "Do you believe in such odd coincidences?" ... said Cytherea. "How do you mean, believe in them? They occur sometimes." ... Yes, one will occur often enough, that is, two disconnected events will fall strangely together by chance, and people scarcely notice the fact beyond saying, "Oddly enough it happened that so and so were the same," and so on. But when three such events coincide without any apparent reason for the coincidence, it seems as if there must be invisible means at work. You see, three things falling together in that manner are 10 times as singular as two cases of coincidence which are distinct. Well, of course. What a mathematical head you have, Cytherea. But I don't see so much to marvel at in our case. That the man who kept the public house in which Miss Aldclyffe fainted, and who found out her name and position, lives in this neighborhood, is accounted for by the fact that she got him the berth to stop his tongue. That you came here was simply owing to Springrove. But look at this. Miss Aldclyffe is the woman our father first loved, and I have come to Miss Aldclyffe's. You can't get over that. From these premises, she proceeded to argue like an elderly divine on the designs of Providence which were apparent in such conjunctures, and went into a variety of details connected with Miss Aldclyffe's history. Had I better tell Miss Aldclyffe that I know all this? She inquired at last. What's the use? He said. Your possessing the knowledge does no harm. You are at any rate comfortable here, and a confession to Miss Aldclyffe might only irritate her. No, hold your tongue, Cytherea. I fancy I should have been tempted to tell her to, Cytherea went on, had I not found out that there exists a very odd, almost imperceptible, and yet real connection of some kind between her and Mr. Manston, which is more than that of a mutual interest in the estate. She is in love with him. Exclaimed Owen. Fancy that. That's what everybody says who has been keen enough to notice anything. I said so at first. And yet now I cannot persuade myself that she is in love with him at all. Why can't you? She doesn't act as if she were. She isn't, you will know I don't say it from any vanity, and she isn't the least jealous of me. Perhaps she is in some way in his power. No she is not. He was openly advertised for, and chosen from 40 or 50 who answered the advertisement, without knowing whose it was. And since he has been here, he has certainly done nothing to compromise herself in any way. Besides, why should she have brought an enemy here at all? Then she must have fallen in love with him. You know as well as I do, Sith, that with women there's nothing between the two poles of emotion towards an interesting male acquaintance. 'Tis either love or aversion. They walked for a few minutes in silence, when Cytherea's eyes accidentally fell upon her brother's feet. She said, do you know that there is something unusual in your manner of walking? What is it like? He asked. I can't quite say, except that you don't walk so regularly as you used to. The woman behind the hedge, who had still continued to dog their footsteps, made an impatient movement at this change in their conversation, and looked at her watch again. Yet she seemed reluctant to give over listening to them. Yes, Owen returned with assumed carelessness, I do know it. I think the cause of it is that mysterious pain which comes just above my ankle sometimes. You remember the first time I had it? That day we went by steam packet to Lulstead Cove, when it hindered me from coming back to you, and compelled me to sleep with the gateman we have been talking about. But is it anything serious, dear Owen? Cytherea exclaimed, with some alarm. Oh, nothing at all. It is sure to go off again. I never find a sign of it when I sit in the office. Again their unperceived companion made a gesture of vexation, and looked at her watch, as if time were precious. But the dialogue still flowed on upon this new subject, and showed no sign of returning to its old channel. Gathering up her skirt decisively, she renounced all further hope, and hurried along the ditch till as he had dropped into a valley, and came to a gate which was beyond the view of those coming behind. This she softly opened, and came out upon the road, following it in the direction of the railway station. Presently she heard Owen Gray's footsteps in her rear, his quickened pace implying that he had parted from his sister. The woman thereupon increased her rapid walk to a run, and in a few minutes safely distanced her fellow traveler. The railway at Carriford Road consisted only of a single line of rails, and the short local down train by which Owen was going to Budmouth was shunted onto a siding whilst the first up train passed. Gray entered the waiting room, and the door being open he listlessly observed the movements of a woman wearing a long gray cloak, and closely hooded, who had asked for a ticket for London. He followed her with his eyes onto the platform, saw her waiting there and afterwards stepping into the train. His recollection of her ceasing with the perception. 4. 8 to 10 o'clock a.m. Mrs. Cricket, twice a widow, and now the parish clerk's wife, a fine-framed, scandal-loving woman, with a peculiar corner to her eye by which, without turning her head, she could see what people were doing almost behind her, lived in a cottage standing nearer to the old manor house than any other in the village of Carriford, and she had on that account been temporarily engaged by the steward, as a respectable kind of charwoman and general servant, until a settled arrangement could be made with some person as permanent domestic. Every morning, therefore, Mrs. Cricket, immediately as he had lighted the fire in her own cottage, and prepared the breakfast for herself and husband, paced her way to the old house, to do the same for Mr. Manston. Then she went home to breakfast, and when the steward had eaten his, and had gone out on his rounds, she returned again to clear away, make his bed, and put the house in order for the day. On the morning of Owen Gray's departure, she went through the operations of her first visit as usual, proceeded home to breakfast, and went back again, to perform those of the second. Entering Manston's empty bedroom, with her hands on her hips, she indifferently cast her eyes upon the bed, previously to dismantling it. Whilst she looked, she thought in an inattentive manner, what a remarkably quiet sleeper Mr. Manston must be. The upper bedclothes were flung back, certainly, but the bed was scarcely disarranged. Anybody would almost fancy, she thought, that he had made it himself after rising. But these evanescent thoughts vanished as they had come, and Mrs. Cricket set to work. She dragged off the counterpane, blankets and sheets, and stooped to lift the pillows. Thus stooping, something arrested her attention. She looked closely, more closely, very closely. Well, to be sure. Was all she could say. The clerk's wife stood, as if the air had suddenly set to amber, and held her fixed like a fly in it. The object of her wonder was a trailing brown hair, very little less than a yard long, which proved it clearly to be a hair from some woman's head. She drew it off the pillow, and took it to the window. There holding it out she looked fixedly at it, and became utterly lost in meditation. Her gaze, which had at first actively settled on the hair, involuntarily dropped past its object by degrees, and was lost on the floor, as the inner vision obscured the outer one. She at length moistened her lips, returned her eyes to the hair, wound it round her fingers, put it in some paper, and secreted the whole in her pocket. Mrs. Cricket's thoughts were with her work no more that morning. She searched the house from roof tree to cellar, for some other trace of feminine existence or appurtenance, but none was to be found. She went out into the yard, coal hole, stable, hay loft, greenhouse, fowl house, and piggery, and still there was no sign. Coming in again, she saw a bonnet, eagerly pounced upon it, and found it to be her own. Hastily completing her arrangements in the other rooms, she entered the village again, and called at once on the postmistress, Elizabeth Leet, an intimate friend of hers, and a female who sported several unique diseases and afflictions. Mrs. Cricket unfolded the paper, took out the hair, and waved it on high before the perplexed eyes of Elizabeth, which immediately mooned and wandered after it like a cat's. "What is it?" said Mrs. Leet, contracting her eyelids, and stretching out towards the invisible object a narrow bony hand that would have been an unmitigated delight to the pencil of Carlo Crivelli. "You shall hear," said Mrs. Cricket, complacently gathering up the treasure into her own fat hand, and the secret was then solemnly imparted, together with the accident of its discovery. A shaving glass was taken down from a nail, laid on its back in the middle of a table by the window, and the hair spread carefully out upon it. The pair then bent over the table from opposite sides, their elbows on the edge, their hands supporting their heads, their foreheads nearly touching, and their eyes upon the hair. "He hobbin mad at her, my lady Cytherea," said Mrs. Cricket, "and 'tis my very belief the hair is no tin. Hers isn't so dark as that," said Elizabeth. "Elizabeth, you know that as the faithful wife of a servant of the church, I should be glad to think as you do about the girl. Mind, I don't wish to say anything against Miss Gray, but this I do say." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.